Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Janice Charette is only the second woman in Canadian history to serve as clerk of the Privy Council, the highest non-elected office in the land. 2 years ago, she moved from that office to become Canadian High Commissioner in London, where, to borrow her own phrase, she has a front row seat to history in the making. She stopped by my office recently, where we chatted about her management style, why she made the issues around mental health in the workplace a key part of her agenda as clerk, and how Brexit presents Canada with some exciting new opportunities. Hey, Janice, thanks for coming by the GAC Files. We saw each other back in January or February in London. You told me you were having a ball.
Indeed.
Not least because you had a ringside seat to history, I think you said.
The front row seat on history.
Front row seat on history. I think you were talking about Brexit and the royal wedding.
I wish.
We assume you have by now collected a whole series of fancy hats for your life over there. But before getting to that, I want to come back here to Canada to talk about your remarkable career as deputy minister, three or four times over as deputy clerk, which you were when we first met in 2012, and then as clerk of the Privy Council, the second woman in Canadian history to hold that office, le greffier.
Le greffière.
Greffière.
Oui, j'ai changé le titre pour réfléchir à le fait que je suis une femme, pas un homme.
Alors, un pionnier. So, for those of you who don't know, that meant that Janice was the boss of 257,000 federal public servants, one of the Prime Minister's closest advisors, deputy minister of the Prime Minister's department. There were about three or four jobs rolled into the clerkship at the same time. But I do want to begin actually at the beginning as to where you were born and what brought you to Ottawa in the first place.
Well, thanks for doing this, David, and giving me a chance to both talk about my story and reflect on it, which I think will be an interesting journey for both of us. I was actually born in Ottawa, one of the few, I think, that you find in this very transient city. So I was born, and as was my husband, believe it or not, and our two children, all four of us, born at the Civic Hospital in Ottawa, which is pretty remarkable.
You have two boys.
No, a boy and a girl. They would kill me if they heard me calling them a boy and a girl now, but a young man and a young lady. So Ottawa has been my home. I lived here for most of my life, although we lived just outside Toronto in a then small town, now growing metropolis of Whitby, Ontario. And but most of my adult life has been spent in Ottawa, so big move to go to London.
Were your parents public servants?
No. I came from, I think it's fair to say, a pretty modest background. My father was a service technician at Consumers Gas, and my mom was a hairdresser. She was a stay-at-home mom. She actually, in those days, I'm not going to tell you when I was born, but it was a long time ago. My mom was working when she became pregnant with me. I'm the oldest in my family. And her employer forced her to quit because they couldn't have a pregnant woman working as a hairdresser, which seems pretty much remarkable to me. But anyways, she was a stay-at-home mom. And then eventually my dad got sick and my mom went back to work. My mom and dad, I would say, graduated from the School of Hard Knocks.
Right.
Didn't have an official certificate on their wall, so I was the first in the family to go to university, I had an upbringing full of love and good values, a little push to, you know, anything you're going to do, you have to do right, which I think becomes a little bit of my career story as well. A loving family, and I'm very fortunate my mom's still here. I'm unfortunately lost my dad, but I have a brother and sister also here in Ottawa. So
wow.
We're Ottawa folk.
Quite a story. So I will steer clear of the age question.
Thank you.
But I do know from public sources that you joined the public service in 1984.
I did.
What did you start as?
I started as a term CO developmental in the Department of Finance in a unit that was corporate finance, was set up in the mid-80s to deal with the fact that the recession of the day was causing companies to come crashing down. And this was a bit of a center of excellence, which was helping, in some cases, government kind of buyouts, government support for large corporates. So despite the fact that the Department of Finance has many great people in it, we didn't necessarily have a corporate or a business center in it. And so that's where I joined. And less than a year later, my unit was wound up and I got reorganized. And that pretty much is the story of government, isn't it?
Plus ça change.
Absolument.
Et après ça, qu'est-ce que t'as fait?
J'ai continué dans le ministère des Finances pour quelques années. Mais j'ai commencé de travailler dans des autres ministères. Une des expériences que je pense que c'était tellement important, ce qui était tellement important pour moi, c'était le fait que j'ai accepté un poste dans le bureau de ministre, ouais. Ministre de Finances. C'était Michael Wilson à l'époque. Et c'était un poste de, ça continue aujourd'hui, le poste de Departmental Liaison.
Ouais.
Pendant cette période, c'était un poste un peu différent qu'aujourd'hui.
Ouais.
J'ai commencé juste après la fuite du budget, le budget leak, le famous budget leak, et j'étais responsable de briefer, de donner un briefage au ministre des Finances chaque jour pour la période de questions. Et j'étais là pour appuyer sur le côté des données et les faits, et je n'étais pas responsable de le côté politique. Mais pendant cette période, j'ai travaillé dans plusieurs tâches dans le bureau de ministre. Alors, j'ai appris beaucoup de ministres.
En ce moment-là, je crois que les bureaux des ministres étaient beaucoup plus petits. Hein?
Nous étions à cette fois, dans cette période, une douzaine, mais pas les structures et la taille d'aujourd'hui.
Ouais,
vous avez raison, absolument.
So you worked in the minister's office. You were a public servant. You at different times, I think, worked for different
ministers.
You had a remarkable rise, became an ADM in which department?
The Department of Justice, as a non-lawyer.
That piqued my interest. What did you do?
I was the senior ADM responsible for the policy sector in the Department of Justice. And I have to say, this was a really good example for me. This is an example I use a lot when I give career advice to anyone, public servants and non-public servants. The deputy minister at the time was a great man who became a deputy minister here, Morris Rosenberg.
Sure.
And I had worked with Morris and around Morris and was just a hugely respectful of him and his leadership and his intellect. And his pitch to me at the time was, and I had to compete for this job like anybody should, his pitch to me was, I have a lot of lawyers in the Department of Justice, but I don't necessarily have someone who really understands how the policy side of Ottawa functions. And so I'd like you to come in and work with the lawyers and the experts to help me to advance the policy agenda of the minister and the government in this space. And so it was as much about culture change as it was about substantive knowledge.
Were you almost an antibody for a while in an ADM team of lawyers?
I think that's too strong because there were a lot more white blood cells killing that, killing this antibody than the contrary. No, I think it was, I was a wingman for Morris, I would say. I was really there to try to help him to change the culture in the organization, which turned out to be not just about how to do policy, how to involve and build a better relationship between regional operations and headquarters. But also, he asked me to be a work-life champion, which is kind of like, I don't know, at the time I thought it was a joke because I thought I would be about the worst person. I have a bit of a reputation for being a pretty hard worker and long hours. But I think it's Nixon to China, right? If you could put Janice in charge of work-life balance, maybe I'd learn something about it or something like that. But the thing that I tell people about my experience at Justice is I didn't necessarily have an affinity or any deep passion for the justice policy issues. I learned those, and I learned to be as passionate about those as I've been about everything else in my career. But I worked for a boss who gave me an incredible amount of space, who empowered me, and who forced me to learn.
Right.
And so if you're trying to choose between, an okay job with a great boss who's going to support you and a really great job but without a great boss, it's a pretty obvious choice to me.
Yeah. I want to come back to that because I want to know a little bit more about what you did as the boss of all of us for a while. But let's just switch to the personal side for a second. You were rising quickly through the ranks. You had these two kids at home. I know that at least one of them was playing a lot of hockey, I think.
So both of them, actually.
Both of them. Mm-hmm. So how did you, were you kind of an ADM or a DM and you're schlepping teenagers around to hockey games? How did you manage all of this?
Well, first thing to say, and the most important factor in both my personal and career success has been my marriage. And so I'm married to a wonderful man who, in our early part of our relationship, we decided early on, knowing the two of us, that he would be the stay-at-home parent of the two of us. And so from the time our son was 3 months old, after that, I went back to work, and my husband stayed home full time with and raised both of our kids.
Wow.
He worked a bit part time as they got a little bit older, but
that
both of them were.
Then.
Oh my gosh, no, it certainly wasn't. So my kids, I'll tell you how old my kids are. That's a fair question. They're 25 and 23, so you're absolutely right. And there were times when my husband's name is Reg. He would go on like play dates, like a lot of stay at home parents do. And he would go on play dates, and then he would hear back from the mom afterwards that maybe her husband wasn't comfortable with him being around during the daytime.
Wow.
So, that's 25 years ago.
Yeah, and that's what it means to be a pioneer. Right?
And now, once the kids went away to university, then he had a lot of the same challenges in terms of stay-at-home parents, in terms of figuring out, okay, so 25 years later, now what am I going to do?
What's my identity?
Now what am I going to do? Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
I'll come back to what he's doing in the UK.
Okay.
All right. So let's switch back to your professional journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in management philosophy would be too fancy a term, but I have read and seen that you have a good sense of humor. I've also been told that you're a pretty hard-driving boss. How do you get the best out of people that you're managing?
I'd like to think I have a sense of humor. That's true. I don't like to think of myself as driving anyone harder than I would drive myself.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that comes from my own, I guess, my own inspiration or what motivates me. And that's why I've worked in politics, I've worked in the public sector, I've worked in the private sector. And I love my work as a public servant. I consider myself a career public servant because I am motivated to do a really great job for the country and for Canadians. And so I come to work every day thinking about, how can I get the most out of myself and the organization that I'm working with in order to, serve government, serve citizens, serve my minister. and my bosses of the day, whoever they were at any level. And that's, I kind of think I took that attitude all the way along. For me, I've learned, and you know, these are lessons hard learned. I'm not sure I was all that fun to work with in my early days of being a senior leader. You know what? I learned a lot from going to retirement parties. And I would listen to the speeches that were given at retirement parties. And people don't, at retirement parties, people don't talk about, you know, a file or a project. What they reflect on
is who you are.
Is who you are, right? What they remember is, you know, that Saturday when people had to come into the office because we had a hot file, you know, you came down and you, you know, thanked everybody for being there, or you showed up with pizza and helped us to put the binders together, right? So it is, and I learned this increasingly as I went along, it really is all about people. It's about picking the best people, not people that are like yourself at all, complimentary to yourself, the smartest people you can find, the people with the sometimes outrageous ideas, not people who think the same way as you. So I'm a huge and early advocate of diversity in teams, absolutely. And then you empower them and you support them. And sometimes, yeah, you hold them accountable when they don't live up to their commitments. Not for making mistakes, because people make mistakes.
Right. But when they let you down.
But when they let themselves down, or they let the organization down.
Yeah. So this, I just can't resist on your retirement party example. There's a book called The Road to Character by the New York Times columnist David Brooks. And the book is really about the difference between leading a life where you build your resume and leading a life where you build your eulogy.
Yeah,
because at your funeral, they don't talk about your CV. They talk about who you are and what's inside you. And I was very taken with this book a couple of years ago, and I've given it to a whole range of people, really as a management treatise in how you treat people, and as you said, the importance of people. And it is something that is easier to live by later on in our career than earlier in your career, once you've gained self-confidence and so on. I do want to, if I forced you to isolate two or three attributes of yourself that were responsible or you would credit for your success as a leader in the Canadian public service, what would they be?
I'd say in no particular order. So this is not rank order, priority or anything, but I work really, really hard. And so maybe too hard on occasion, but so I can carry a big load and deliver. Secondly, I would say that I have a ingrained tendency to run towards problems, to fix them. And so maybe sometimes reacting too quickly to fix problems. So that's something that I've really had to monitor and manage in myself. But I just can't resist when I see something that I think, you know,
breaking or broken
or could be better. I kind of decide, I put my shoulder behind it, and I just really want to make a difference. And I think the third thing is that, hopefully anyways, that I have a reputation of somebody who people like to work with, despite the fact that there's no question. I remember doing one of my early executive assessment processes. I got a feedback of being tough but fair. I'm sure if my boss of the day is listening to this, he probably is laughing. He has no idea what kind of an impact that had on me, right? And so I've always tried to make sure that I focused more on the fair than the tough, because the tough came naturally, right? So I really was careful about, you know, about the fair side.
As a newly minted member of the DM community who's facing his first feedback later today.
Today.
Yeah, I'm getting a call later today, so I'll let you know how that goes. What about your decision-making style? Are you somebody who needs all of the evidence, or are you more of a go-with-your-gut person?
I would say I have two different decision-making styles. When the time allows and the situation allows, I tend to be very much of a, I was going to say collaborative decision making. I don't think that's really it. What I seek are lots of various inputs. There's nothing that makes me happier than to pull 10 people around a table and just talk something through and hear different perspectives.
Everyone's
and test my idea.
Something.
Exactly. And as much as possible, kind of, it's almost like the family dinner table. You get everybody around the table, which is what, you know, one of my first department as a deputy minister, I was immigration, as it was then called, citizenship and immigration. We could get actually all the management team around the table and thrash out an issue. And so that really helped my decision making. And so I like to do that. But there are times when you don't have that.
You got to move too quickly.
You got to move. There's a crisis. And so there I'm absolutely a go with my gut person. It has served me well. And you spend your whole life kind of refining your gut to actually be that what gets you through the tough spots.
How about on people? Are you sort of intuitive on – I talked to Marc-André Blanchard, who's our ambassador to the permanent rep to the UN in New York, and he was head of Canada's largest law firm. And he says that he – never considered himself a brilliant lawyer, but he considered himself a brilliant talent spotter.
I'm a pretty good talent spotter as well, I would say. I do have a tendency, though, to go with a dark horse over a natural establishment candidate, sometimes because it's good to have an agent provocateur around the table, just to kind of show a different side of things to you. I can sometimes be a bit too quick to judge, and so that's something that I've really worked on as well. Exactly, like, you know, let people. Some people, you know, show differently in different circumstances.
And over, different circumstances, different amounts of time.
I also think I am pretty good at second and even third chances.
Right.
So
very important.
I don't have
you don't bear a grudge.
Once and you're out.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a little bit of a grudge, but but very few.
Okay. Quand je pense de ta contribution comme greffeuse, je pense immédiatement de la santé mentale. Janice was a very strong, and is a very strong advocate for issues of mental health in the workplace, and that is now part of all EXPMAs, I believe. So there's even an accountability for all of us to say on an annual basis how we've contributed to that agenda. Where did it come from?
This is not a short answer, I had the honor, I would say, of chairing the United Way campaign for the Government of Canada, our annual charitable campaign. And that exposed to me, I mean, I worked in a national platform my whole career, but this gave me a local look. And I started to understand about some of the challenges in the community. And at the end of that, I decided I wanted to actually make a contribution in the community and take my skills and see what I could do. About the same time, there was a tragic incident, which is public, so I can talk about it, of the suicide of Darren Richardson. Darren was the daughter of Stephanie and Luke Richardson. Luke played for the Ottawa Senators. They have another daughter named Morgan, and Morgan Richardson and my daughter Cassie played hockey together. And so we knew the Richardsons well. We'd spent lots of hours around the hockey rink with them, and you get to know each other pretty well. And so when Darren committed suicide, it was a shock, I would say, to all of us. Of course, to her parents, but to all of us.
How old was she?
She was 14, and nobody saw it coming.
Right.
This was a wonderful, wonderful young lady with bubbly personality, talent, smarts, great family, beautiful. It just kind of came out of nowhere. And so that was, it was kind of like a bolt of lightning to me that if I was going to do something, I was going to see what I could do to help mental health. So I joined the board of the Royal Ottawa here. And I've been really focused on access to mental health services, particularly for young people. And there are some transition issues in our system. But as I took on roles as both the deputy clerk of the Privy Council and then as clerk, I had a responsibility as well for the kind of health and wellness of the public service as a whole. And the statistics in terms of the prevalence of mental illness in our society are, you can't argue with them. Mm. And so both from the compassionate, empathetic side of my personality in terms of caring about people, but also from a productivity and bottom line absentee perspective, it made absolute sense to me to think about, okay, what's our biggest wellness issue? And it was stigma and the fact that people didn't feel comfortable to talk about it and people didn't have the tools to talk about it or deal with it in our workplace. And, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but if you can actually change the life of just one person, it makes it worthwhile. A number of public servants across the country that have spoken to me, that have written to me about this, that it made them feel more comfortable in the workplace. And actually, I think we retained more people, and we have people who are making an even better contribution as a result of it. So I couldn't be prouder of this.
Well, as someone who left the public service and then came back, it's a really dramatic difference.
That's interesting.
The sense that it's okay to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear.
It's okay to, as part of your role as a manager, to ask how people are doing and to expect an honest and fulsome response.
And to be equipped somehow. An answer that's like, sure, not so great today.
Right.
Right.
And that's, as I was saying, I think certainly a large part of your legacy as clerk. So post-clerk, you were asked to become our High Commissioner to London,
right,
which is one of our absolute jewels in the Canadian diplomatic service. I'm interested in your front row seats to what's going on there. Obviously an extraordinarily challenging time for Britain and the world, Britain and Europe, obviously Britain and the world. Where does Canada fit in as one of Britain's closest friends and allies historically?
It is it's a fascinating time to be in the United Kingdom. And so there's no question it's not an easy time for our friends, the Brits, as they go through now trying to decide their future outside the European Union. And of course, there's all the machinations around Brexit and what the future relationship is going to be in the economic and security and defense side. But I think that, and the EU and the UK will have those negotiations. And, you know, our job is to try and make sure we manage any risk to Canadian interests through all of that. But as I look at it, I think that there's a real opportunity for Canada here. And as the UK thinks of their future outside the European Union, they'll be looking around the world for who are our partners, who are our allies, who are our friends, who can we do business with? And I think Canada's ideally positioned. And I think it's fair to say that if you look back over the last, the UK has been in the EU for 40 years, give or take. And in that period, I think that, we've had a wonderful relationship. We have a lot in common, but it's not clear to me that we kind of made any effort to get the most out of it.
It's not been, there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of momentum there, but it's not been, what can we do together?
Yeah, not necessarily purposeful, exactly.
Not
right?
Deliberate. Sure.
So we've really, I think, tried to, carpe diem, as they say, take advantage of the fact that that there is this possibility. And actually last September 2017, Prime Minister May came to visit Prime Minister Trudeau here. And so they had a meeting, and the Prime Ministers agreed on an action plan of what we're going to do together. And that covers what we would consider to be kind of traditional areas of cooperation, security, defense, and so on. But it includes some interesting new areas, science, technology, research, innovation, where our interests and our priorities are completely aligned.
Climate change,
indirectly, but more as a how are we moving to a clean growth, green economy,
which fits with innovation and science and technology.
Yeah, I think that's right. But the other interesting parts of all of this were, I like to consider it kind of like the plumbing and wiring of the relationship, which sounds really boring. The Prime Ministers agreed to an annual strategic dialogue between ministers of foreign affairs, development, and defense. So an annual strategic dialogue that doesn't exist with any other partner, three plus three, where we can actually sit down and talk about what are the issues on which we together can make a difference.
Boring, but hugely important in terms of pushing things ahead.
And also, we've done the same thing in terms of the public service. Yeah. So my successor, the clerk of the Privy Council, will meet with his counterpart, the Secretary of the Cabinet, Clerk of the Privy Council in the UK, called a little bit differently, different title there, along with a number of deputy ministers. And that means that every year we'll have this opportunity, both at the political level and the senior ranks of the public service, to check how we're doing on the relationship.
Making it more deliberate.
Deliberate, and I think, you know, if Canada is smart about this, and I sure hope, as long as I'm in London, we're going to work on this. That's my, you know, trying to make progress instincts coming through. If we push on this agenda, I think it's pushing on an open door, and we've got the mechanisms to make it happen. So it's up to us to be ambitious about the relationship, and I think our partners in the UK will be very welcoming of that.
Before I let you go, I joked at a function yesterday that I don't have a real job description. That's part of being an associate deputy minister. But you have viewed global affairs and its predecessors from the outside. You're now looking at it as one of us from the inside. What advice would you give to me as to two or three things where I should lean in and try to make the kind of change that you're famous for?
I'll start with the positives because that's kind of how I like to start. I am continuously impressed with the passion and the dedication and the conviction of people colleagues that I meet here at Global Affairs, who are prepared not just to go to the, you know, nice places like London, but who are prepared to go into some of the more difficult and challenging parts of the world and try and carry the Canada flag and make a difference on the ground, not just for Canadians, but, you know, to try and rescue human rights workers, you know, female human rights workers who are run out of the country and who risk their life, you know, putting their own personal safety on the line.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's really, it's noble and it's impressive, and it comes from, I think, a sense of vocation. And so I'm really impressed with that. But there's a but, an and, I don't know about. It kind of goes to your point about I'm one of you now.
Yeah.
I will never be one of you. I am from the outside. I am not Global Affairs. I don't know the stories. I'm not part of the guild, as someone described it once to me.
No one's given you the secret handshake?
I couldn't find the secret handshake with a map. And so I think that's one thing that, and there's a really important balance to be struck here. And I would not for a second suggest to you that we throw out a department that is steeped in experience and knowledge and has that ability to interact not just, you know, in Ottawa, but really around the world. So we need knowledge and experience and expertise. But there has to be some way as well to acknowledge that in 2018 and certainly going forward, there is no difference between international and domestic. And so we got to think about how we build the people component that's going to allow us to deliver internationally what we need to do for Canada. And I can't help but think that that is
not just
the workforce
affairs
that we have today. And maybe it doesn't mean, we're talking about the mission of the future. We're talking about headquarters of the future as well. So how do we build a headquarters that works in this town in the way that, you know, networked, all the things we've been talking about. We've been at a head of mission meeting for the last 2 days. And we've talked a lot about getting out of kind of just the regular relationships where people or heads of mission go in and talk to government people, right? Are we engaging with civil society actors? Yeah. Are we engaging with businesses? How do we do that in this city and engage with a broader group of stakeholders so that, you know, what we do for Canada internationally is taking advantage of all that skill and expertise?
Not just Global Affairs.
Yeah.
We're going to run out of time, but I would remiss if I didn't ask what your husband's doing in London.
He's a very patient soul. So right now, we're just at the coming to the end of our second year. My gosh, it goes awfully quickly. And so he is mostly spending his time enjoying all of the wonders of London. He's become a very good tour guide for our frequent visitors. London tends to be a place lots of people come to visit. But the other thing is that, unlike every job I've ever had in my career, I think being a High Commissioner, at least in London, is a team sport.
Right.
And so
he participates.
So. And, you know, he has voluntarily taken on the role within the mission of reaching out to the new CBS that are coming into the mission every year, but also to their spouses. So there's a little bit of an informal network, which I gather we used to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm calling myself part of we. Yeah. We used to have once upon a time.
We'll get you yet.
But, and he really enjoys doing that. So the people who may be having a little struggle or need a little extra help, he's trying to do that as well. And he became a beekeeper until he developed a bee allergy for our bees that we have on the roof of Canada House in London, which is magnificent. And we look forward to welcoming you back there really soon.
Well, Janice, toujours un plaisir.
Merci.
This has been great. I would love to come back and visit you in London, and we'll catch up again then.
Vous serez bienvenue n'importe quand.
Okay, merci beaucoup.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.